This time on the show,
you're a little bit of a gardener.
Timing and acting and staging are at the crossroads.
And everything about ballet is disappointing if you're looking for a plot.
All this and more on Comics Are Great. It's Comics Are Great, the visual storytelling show recorded at the Ann Arbor District Library in downtown Ann Arbor, Michigan, comicsaregreat.com. I'm Drewzy Drozd, a cartoonist and teaching artist, which is to say a person who makes comic books and teaches classes on how to make comics, and I am the co-author of the upcoming Science Comics Rockets, and with me is my co-host,
Ann Drozd. I am a librarian here at the Ann Arbor District Library, and it's great to be back with Comics Are Great after a little bit of a break.
And not only are you a librarian, there's more to you than that.
I'm also a cartoonist. I am the co-author of Rockets, which will be coming out in June.
June of 2018. Yeah. It's been a while since we've done the show. And for those who are new to it, it's a visual storytelling show where we talk with people in and around the business of telling stories with images, right? And we're back with an interview with a grand visual storyteller and editor, author, illustrator.
My name's Mark Siegel. I'm the editorial and creative director of First Second Books, which is the Macmillan graphic novel imprint. And I'm also an author and illustrator.
So we can jump right in with, since you listed that you have many roles, how do you think about managing such different roles, and how does that affect the work that you do?
Yeah, I wear different hats, but on good days, they feel like they're part of the same story, essentially. Even though I kind of have different functions in different places, but in a way, so I've got my editorial life, and that takes place in an office in the Flatiron Building in New York City. And then I have my studio life, which takes place a little bit everywhere, sometimes on trains and sometimes in my studio, where projects are cooking. So the thing about First Second is that it's a publishing house, so it's a business. But to me, it's first of all, it's another project. And in this case, it's a bit like creating an ecology for certain things to be possible. So it's essentially a home for authors and creators and artists, specifically in comics. So we're doing, you know, we only do graphic novels, and we do them for all different ages, from young readers to teens to adults. And there's no single house style. There's an incredible range of styles and themes and genres represented under the same roof. And it's always a work in progress. And part of making a good home and making it a place where talented creators can thrive means it needs to be a successful business. But that really isn't the original goal. It's really making it that home, and then everything else kind of that requires, you know. So I've had to learn a lot about business and about publishing and publishing in America. But at the heart of it is really a wish to foster a certain kind of work into the world. And some of that I feel like we've accomplished some of the vision, and some of it is yet to be realized. And then I have my own stuff, which is me in some ways turning inwardly and not thinking about the marketplace and not thinking about business and really trying to answer to my muse and my own creative urgings. And some of that, you know, I do as an illustrator. So I've illustrated picture books for other authors. And then sometimes I'm doing the writing as well.
You describe different spaces, and you used the word ecology a little while ago, yeah, which I thought was really interesting. And so I wonder if the different spaces help you with those different mindsets that are required.
Yeah, very much, very much, very much. Like, I think one of the things that can plague everybody, especially creative people is the ego. You know, we all have to deal with it, and sometimes it really gets in the way. And I like the idea, when you think in terms of ecology, then you're a little more like a gardener in whatever you happen to be doing, you know. And I think of this as like different plots in my life, and they have different requirements for gardening, you know. Or if you think, if you've ever made like a little terrarium or something, you know, you kind of introduce things into an environment, and then it changes with every new addition, you know. And I think of projects that way as well, you know, that I'm tending to things, and like I have my own little kind of morning journal process where I kind of check in to see what might be growing, what might be sprouting. I like those kinds of metaphors work really well for me in general. I feel like it's a way of, sometimes when we get too personal and we think like, oh, I have to do this, and I have to be a great cartoonist, or I have to be a brilliant editor, or, you know, we end up short-circuiting the real magic, as opposed to like, okay, let's just tend to something and set things in motion and see how they grow, you know. Because I really think projects, just like an imprint or a business or anything you launch or, you know, establish, it ends up having a life of its own. You know, I think the best projects end up escaping their creators in some ways. So I like to kind of think that way from the start, if possible.
Well, you mentioned that you had to learn a lot about the American publishing industry, and that skill that you use as an editorial director. Does that influence the work that you do as an author-illustrator, or do you try not to have that influence that side of things?
It's hard to say how much it influences. I think anytime you build a skill set in any field, you know, like even if it's repairing cars or something, it's going to become part of the fabric of what you bring to bear on anything you do. So I think you benefit and you learn stuff like, you know, negotiating or even understanding the marketplace, you know, and the forces at play in the market and that kind of stuff, which is interesting, you know, and I think it flavors things. I don't see how it couldn't, but it is, you know, I do feel like it lives in a different place than like the heart of my, you know, when I'm focusing in on a project, on a story, say, or on an illustration.
As somebody who teaches comics classes in Ann Arbor, something that I run into when I talk to my students' parents is sort of an unawareness with how a diversification of skill sets can actually benefit an aspiring author, you know? And like, it seems obvious when we think about it a little bit that like, yeah, get lots of life experience and then you'll have something to say. But even like a lack of awareness that, well, they want to make graphic novels someday, so they just need to learn to draw. That's all. And then they ask me, and they're very nervous for their children, which is great. I'm really glad they're so concerned. But they say, but what if comics doesn't work out? What would they do with that skill? You know, if they're not going to make comics, then what can they do? You know, I'm like, well, there's lots of things you can do, you know, because there's so many skills involved. So I wonder if, like, what you would say, like, and I'm asking for personal advice here, Mark, what would you say to that parent who's concerned?
No, it's so true. It's so true that the thing about comics, it's an interesting journey. You know, in a few cases, I've had to, you know, there's times when I signed up people, speaking now as an editor, you know, I've signed up some people who were a little green and, you know, but very promising. And in that case, you know, you end up having to hold hands, you know, and coach someone along. And you really do come to appreciate the fact that what goes into comics is an incredible range of skills. And there's skills that range from the writing and the storytelling. Yeah, there's definitely there's artistry, there's the draftsmanship, all that. But then at the kind of crossroads of those, is a whole bunch of stuff about timing, about acting, about directing, about staging, you know, things that you would think of as belonging to other fields completely. And it's very interesting to see the, you know, people who are really great at, say, acting the kind of unspoken in their comics, you know, and that really is, it's like stagecraft, you know. And so I think anybody pushing into comics, like, you can never, it's never a waste, you know. It's like, is it a waste to learn piano? Like, what if you can't make a living playing piano? Well, no. Your appreciation of music, your feeling, your emotional life, you know, I mean, many would say your spiritual life is deepening, you're growing as a human being. And yeah, speaking to the young practitioners and the aspiring comics creators, it's also really important to not just consume comics. You know, like when I started First Second, a lot of the stuff, the submissions we would get were, a lot of them were manga, you know, and it was like many kids who were in art school who read manga, who drew manga, who lived manga, who cosplayed manga. And it was like, you know, you need to open the windows and let in some fresh air from elsewhere. Because it's not, you know, it's like you can be in a kind of asphyxiation if you're just in your specialized geekdom, as opposed to being a full, well-rounded human, you know, which is always going to be, you're going to be a much greater source of work, of story, you know, of impressions and wisdom also, if you're experiencing other things. Like, I love that about some of the, you know, if you take some of the French people, like Sfar is a big star in France, Sean Sfar, he's got, you know, there's Greek philosophers, there's Talmudic writing, there's klezmer music, there's North Africa, there's like all these different currents running through his comics. If he was just a comics geek, then you wouldn't have all that richness.
It seems like it's a very good way of connecting with a lot more people rather than just being a mirror of one thing.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories is this: these two guys who wanted to become Hollywood screenwriters, and they said, "Well, before we do that, let's open up a restaurant, so we can meet lots of people, and then go become then we'll amass a bunch of characters, and now we can actually write about something." Right.
I think one of the unspoken intentions of First Second was to create comics that connect outside the comics world, you know, and I think some do, and not all of them, but some do, you know, some really connect with people, whether or not they favor comics, you know, whether they like reading comics themselves. And I think that's the mark of when something goes deeply enough into whatever it's into, that other people can connect to that. Like I kind of use my wife Sienna as a useful barometer with that stuff, because it's like comics is, she's not, her first instinct is not going to be to read a graphic novel for her own pleasure, you know. And she, when she connects, like Vera Brosgal really gets to her, or we published Spill Zone, which really connected for her, then I know, okay, we're kind of reaching outside the, you know, I like the geekdom idea. It's like, cause, and I belong to it myself, you know, so I'm not always unbiased that way.
And it's nice that there would be the idea of people just seeing a comic as a story container rather than, oh, that's a comic, I would never read it because I don't read comics. And I mean, that goes into, I'm a librarian here at the Ann Arbor District Library, and we do have a separate section for comics. And we've been trying to think a little bit more about the different genres within comics to make people realize that comics itself isn't a genre, and it's just another way to tell stories.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the the thing about the form of comics is that it's a form, it's a format, it's a medium. So it's I think the same applies to novels, to movies, to music. These other formats are, you know, there's a lot of crap, but there's also a lot of gems. You know, there's some work that's going to stand the test of time, that's going to add to humanity in some way. And in comics now, there's more and more and more of that. You know, so I think a lot of it is to do with like, who are you, you know, what are you, who and what are you connecting to through the work? You know, is it inspired? Is it meaningful? It doesn't have to be serious necessarily, but is it, does it, you know, does it add to your life in some way? Or, you know, who is it? Some famous writer said, a bad book is a thief.
That's a great line. Can we talk about one of your books?
Oh, sure. Gladly.
We're looking at Sailor Twain, which was published by First Second, and then Five Worlds, which was published by Random House. And I guess I'm kind of wondering, how do you decide where a project should be pitched or published? And are different publishers reaching out to different audiences in different ways that would help you determine where a project would fit, like what would be a good home for your project?
Yeah, a little bit. I think different houses signal sometimes slightly different audience. But mainly, I think you want to land with an editor who's passionate about your work, who believes in that particular project. I think for a book to work, it needs to line up champions in order to pop above the noise. You know, it's a very noisy marketplace. It's a very crowded marketplace. So you're looking for champions. You know, if you're not self-publishing and doing all your own championing, which I can't, it's like I find that too wearing. I don't enjoy it so much. But in the case, Sailor Twain was an experiment, and I had the latitude to publish something under my own roof, which then after having done it, even though it went well, but I decided, okay, if I can avoid publishing under First Second, I will. You know, partly because it's always a little fraught. You know, you're the editor, you have these authors that you're championing, and then suddenly on one season there's your book, you know, and whatever happens for it, there's always this question, is it sucking oxygen away from these other books? You know, are you giving yourself special favors? Or the more likely scenario is like, are you kind of giving yourself short shrift, you know, and then in which case you'd be better off somewhere else. And so, you know, I think partly first step for finding the right home for a project is there someone passionate alongside of you, you know, with your project? And then do they have the means to really push it out there and support it? And it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, it has to be a giant house. It can be an indie, it can be, but it's like, are they gonna be able to get behind it and kind of draw some attention to it, or give it a moment in the sun?
I heard you talk recently on the Listen to My Art podcast. Actually, it was a few months back. And you also talked about, you know, researching what a publishing house does so that when you're submitting something, it actually, you know, looks like it might belong there. But one word that you used that I thought was really fascinating, I'm hoping we can unbox it a little bit, is this notion of, you talked about the handwriting of the author. And you talked about how books have like books that excite you have a certain kind of idiosyncratic handwriting. I wonder if we can unpack that a little bit and explain what that means when you say that.
Yeah, I love that. And I feel, you know, that is I mean, it's true for picture books in a certain way, but I feel like with comics, maybe above all, it's a visual handwriting, you know. And I feel that, you know, a lot of the more commercial manga has kind of become a de facto handwriting. You know, a lot of the kind of classic golden silver age comics have a certain kind of visual handwriting. Now, the beauty of the graphic novel, kind of author-based graphic novel, is nowadays that visual handwriting is as personal as the author's own voice. And I like comics that make use of that, that actually treat that as a strength and an asset, and not forced into some kind of a weird conformity to like some idea of realism or some idea of like big eyes and spiky hair and stuff like that.
Or like in the old days, the house styles of DC and Marvel, right?
Exactly. Which even they have really changed now, but still, they're still working within a certain kind of canon. But yeah, so with comics, you know, it's an interesting thing when you see people make the jump from illustration, like editorial illustration or picture book illustration, and they try to make comics. Oftentimes, they make this mistake where they think it's about making beautiful panels. And what happens oftentimes when people go for a really lavish kind of illustrative style in comics is they often kill the rhythm of the reading. And I like, one of the ones I like to point to for a kind of a mastery of this stuff is Mike Mignola. When in Hellboy, he knows how to slow down his reader with lots of detail, or speed up the reader. Like in the action scenes, there's no detail. There's just like a color in the background and a kind of a minimalist design. And that's because it's not about pretty pictures. It's really about the flow. It's about the sequence. It's like the beauty is not necessarily in the individual panel. It might be in the spread. It might be in a sequence of spreads. So it's not like you can, you know, comics are never that great in museums. You know, once they're framed and put up on a wall, sometimes they're a little weird, because it has that feeling of like this is not the way they're meant to be processed. You know, and so I love that. I love the visual handwriting thing. There's actually a seminal French comics guy called Baudouin, Edmond Baudouin, who's one of his famous quotes is that he says, in comics, your artwork has to be really, really good and a little bit not good.
That is great. Oh, that's so good.
Actually, it's not about showing off your chops as an artist in that panel. It's actually about taking your reader by the hand and leading them, you know, from moment to moment. And some people are astonishing artists. I mean, you mentioned before our call, Ciro Pedrosa in France, or if you look at Gillian Tamaki and what, you know, just about any panel from this one summer is a gorgeous thing to look at. But she's also a very good comics storyteller. So, you know, it's always serving the purpose of that story flow. It's about the emotion. It's about the acting. It's about that emotional beat at any given time. It's never kind of screaming like, hey, look at me, look what I can do. I feel like all this is kind of inside that visual handwriting idea.
I love this framing of, it's not any individual panel. The comics is the, well, as you put it, Anne, the container. It's the whole, and you have to judge it that way. And if you're stopping to say like, well, they didn't draw a background on that panel, you're kind of missing the point, right? You're being myopic and missing out on what the whole thing is saying. But I have to wonder about like, well, Anne and I had a disagreement about this before the show. I was calling them tools. What were you calling them? Media, right?
Well, we were talking about the specific tools or medium in which you might be drawing a comic. Like if you are using pen and ink, or if you are doing watercolor or charcoal or...
And having revisited Sailor Twain this week and Five Worlds this week, we were like, oh, wow, right? Like just the stark difference. And you were even, which children's book were you reading of his that you showed me?
The Long Night Moon, I really liked in the the end of the book where there's the little blurb about how you came upon drawing it in charcoal and how you had tried different mediums.
I mean, I tend to be that way with all my projects. I kind of approach them afresh with, you know, I'm open to trying something completely new and starting over. I think some people are more wedded to a particular tool. You know, it's like even a particular brush or a particular nib or, and for me, it's not like that, you know, but it's not to say, I think it can take time to actually figure out what works for you. You know, for me, I spent years doing comics with a nib because I assumed it had to be done that way.
And then
it was a friend who was actually brutally honest with me one day who said, like, you know, that's not the right tool for you. And I was like, and at first I was kind of like, oh no, I suck. I can't. But then I kind of got over that. And then I started playing and discovered that I was enjoying myself so much more with other things, you know. And charcoal, I really love. I did another picture book called Oscar and the Eight Blessings in charcoal and digital color. And then Sailor Twain, of course. And it's like, to me, charcoal is like sculpting. You know, you put some on, you take some off, and you're kind of kneading it, and it's messy, and it's like, it's very tactile. It's a mess, though. It's a mess to scan. It's a mess to preserve. And you're spraying a ton of spray fixative and bad stuff for the environment. So, but it works. For me, that works. And I like the softness, and I like the, it's a little bit like classical Chinese painting where you can hint at stuff, where when you're working in hard black and white ink, you can also, but it's a different thing. It tends to be more crisp, you know, and exact. And I like things that disappear into the fog a little bit sometimes. But yeah, I feel like the tool, to me, the tool is part of, you know, if you approach a project, you go, what belongs, you know? And it's, again, back to that visual handwriting idea. It's like the tool is going to be a part of your visual handwriting. So if you're working in a brush, you know, are you happy, you know, or do you enjoy it? Because you can feel, you know, some people, you feel the joy that they have, you know, and some people, you feel a ton of joy in their pencils, and then they go to ink and it's misery, and it shows. You know, it's a chore and they're bored, you know, and it goes a bit stiff and a bit dead, you know, so maybe they need to come at it a different way. You know?
I was just actually using Sailor Twain in one of my classrooms where I was trying to point at this notion of using tools with some kind of intentionality, tools, media with some kind of intentionality. Like, is this the right tool for the job, not is this the right tool, right? Because I'm dealing with high school students who are very earnestly asking that question, like, well, what's the right one to get? What should I buy when I get home? That kind of thing. And so I held up, you know, the first page of Sailor Twain, and they were like, oh. I'm like, yeah, so what feelings does this give us? And they're like, it feels like it's very dark and wet and mysterious. I'm like, exactly. You know, that was the right tool for that moment to create that sense, whereas you know, something a little bit more crisp and vibrant and colorful, like, for instance, Five Worlds, evokes a completely different feeling, right? So, yeah, it's – but I want to underline what you said there that I think is really great is, like, the sense of playing, too, being playful to arrive at that rather than having, like, this rigor of I must find the right tool, right? Like, intentionality can easily be misunderstood to being effort and rigor versus – playfully getting there and being alert for when the right tool shows itself or right process shows itself.
Yeah, and it does. It really does. To me, in my own process, it tends to be one of the last steps when I'm ready to start doing finished pages. You know, and I think, you know, a lot of young aspiring cartoonists tend to jump to finished pages too soon, you know, and they don't do their homework. They don't gather the stuff. They don't do the prep work. You know, it's a bit like painting a house or something. You know, you have to, there's a lot of prep. And then the execution sometimes is comparatively kind of fast. Not always, but sometimes. And to me, it's kind of when the project announces itself and it's like, okay, here I am. This is what I look like. Like with Sailor Twain, I had done some pages. I had done quite a lot of pages in an ink wash with brush. And it wasn't right. And then it was, again, a bit like Long Night Moon. I was noodling around playing with charcoal. And I was like, oh, damn, this is the Hudson. This is the mood. This is the age of steam and coal, you know, and smoke and mist and rain. You know, I want to draw all those things, right? Because I'm holding a piece of charcoal in my hand. So then what's interesting is that the tool itself can start to teach you once it clicks. You know, I think you can be in a kind of a receptive, I kind of want to say an inferior engagement. It's like you make yourself apprentice to your project, you know, and that's true for Five Worlds, where there's five of us working on that project, and our boss is the project.
But Mark, that means that you're not in control. You're not the creative genius who's steering this thing.
Exactly. Exactly. Thank you. I love that. I mean, yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it's a hard one because we live in a culture that put so much emphasis and so much reward on that ego.
Yeah, you know? Steve Jobs, right? You yell at people to get your way and you steer the ship because you have the vision to make this thing exactly as you see it, right?
Yeah, as opposed to really being a servant. And it's interesting, Steve Jobs, I think, was coming around to that at the end of his life by the sound of it. But yeah, it's a much more useful way to think, is to be in service to something. I think it keeps a door open for much longer. I think ego leads to writer's block. It leads to stagnation creatively. It leads to all kinds of crisis moments that are not necessary. But that's for each person's own journey and their own path, I think, to kind of run up against that in themselves. But like, so an example of listening to that project, like with Sailor Twain, I knew that I was trying to draw out a contrast between two men. There's Captain Twain, who's this kind of, he's Anglo-Saxon, and he starts off a bit like buttoned up and sort of uptight, and he's kind of a model captain, but he's a bit rigid, and he's drawn all in black and white and in a kind of iconic style. That's like almost like geometric shapes, you know, like two big circles for eyes, a kind of a triangle for a nose. And then Lafayette he starts out as a kind of a Latin, he's almost a cliche Latin lover, but he turns out to be a little more complex than that. And he's drawn all in shades of gray and in a more naturalistic looking thing, but a little bit exaggerated. He's a little bit like a musketeer out of, you know, Three Musketeers. And then there's the women characters. It's interesting, if you look at the mermaid, you know, she's a fantastical creature, but she is more realistic and naturalistic than the captain, you know. So then you start getting into, you know, that subliminal level of comics, which, you know, you can do stuff like that. And I love that, the fact that you're kind of the style you apply can tell your story just as much as dialogue and everything else you're using.
Going back to what you mentioned for Five Worlds, how there were five people on the team making that story happen, and then going back to what we were talking about and the term that you had, the handwriting of the author, I know a lot of people, when there's a collaboration, will, after they've experienced the project, will come to the creators and be like, okay, who did what and how do you divide this? So I'm really curious to know how the handwriting of each member of that collaboration really shows through, or how it melds together and how that worked with that project.
Yeah, because I feel like magically that project, it really does have its handwriting, and it's distinct from each one of our individual handwritings. It's unique to this project. And at first, you know, my brother and I were writing, and we were kind of thinking this was going to be hired guns. You know, that's how it started. We were going to bring on a team and they were going to basically do what they were told. And, you know, they would kind of follow our lead. And And very quickly, it was really, there was a magical moment where they signed on and we were scripting. And then I thumbnail, I take the script that we work up, which is a kind of a working script, meaning we're going to just bash it all the way till the last minute. You know, it's not going to be anything set in stone. Then I thumbnail that out. And then that's kind of that's the springboard for the art team to take and work with. And when I sent in my first, was it a script? I think it was the script, but they got a copy. They each read it. And then they got on a Skype call with us, and there was this awkward thing where they were actually very nervous, but they were like, so is it okay if we have some notes? You know, and they were ready for me to kind of be displeased, you know, or something. But I was thrilled. I was like, oh, please, yeah, what, you know? And they're like, so it feels like it works really well up to this point, but then we're like, so, and they were really good notes. And so next thing that happened is we're suddenly together generating into this story and generating into the world building and generating into the character designs. You know, I had a preliminary character design because I had filled up many, many little sketchbooks with watercolors and doodles and stuff. But they would take them and explore and push, you know, and develop new things. And Matt, for example, he's our kind of resident Mobius, and he can make, you know, amazing places that you totally believe exist, you know. And he had notebooks full of, it's almost like he had gone on a tourist trip around the five worlds, you know, and sketched places he'd seen. You know, and so then that started feeding back into our story, into our writing, into my thumbnailing, you know, and then the interesting thing was, you know, we knew from the start we didn't want to do the kind of classic assembly line, you know, where you have the penciler, inker, letterer, which can often make things a little dead, or, you know, it just, I think it curtails the kind of passion that each player is going to put in.
It does feel very Industrial Revolution, doesn't it?
It is, yeah, exactly. It's like, yeah, it is efficient.
Yeah.
It is, you know, you can get a Ford Model T, you know, out the door that way. but it's not the same as like five people who have their hearts pouring into a project. You know, that's going to have a very different energy.
You seem to be at peace with ambiguity. That's what I'm hearing out of this.
Yeah. I think ambiguity is not for its own sake, but for the sake of staying open, is a valuable thing.
So this book we're talking about is a big, not big in terms of page length, although it is, it's a sizable read, but it's a big world. And I feel like maybe we should summarize it as best we can. Now, we have an option. If you have a succinct summary that you want to use, go for it, or you can hear what we put together.
Oh, I would love to hear what you put together. It's a hard one to, yeah.
It was really hard to pin this down. So do you mind if I take the...
No, please.
Go for it.
All right. So epic fantasy science fiction in the tradition of series like Avatar the Last Airbender, multiple worlds with various cultures and sentient species that once lived in harmony, but something went wrong and things have steadily been going out of balance, both ecologically and culturally. One of our unlikely heroes is the sand dancer Una, who is grieving over the disappearance of her sister Jessa. Sand dancers manipulate sand into animated forms, or aniforms, which they use in a ceremony vital to keeping balance within and between their worlds. Here Una's grief is doubled. For Jessa was a sand dancer of merit who was chosen to perform the ceremony, and that job may have fallen on Una, who happens to be the clumsiest student at the Sand Dancer Academy. So she's got big shoes to fill and plenty of reason to frustrate everyone around her. After an attack on the sand castle in which Una discovers a different kind of sand is being weaponized to overthrow the other world, she falls in with two other young heroes. Please correct me on my pronunciations if I get this wrong. Ansu, a boy from the slums who has unlocked top-level skills in negotiating and getting out of trouble, and Jax Amboy, a starball athlete of great prowess and fame whose calm and detached demeanor suggests secrets under the surface. And together, these heroes have to restore balance to their civilization and uncover a conspiracy between the people of one of the worlds and a dark creature called the Mimic.
Whoa. You guys, man. Nicely done.
Oh, great. Nicely done.
Yeah, it's a crazy amount of plotting we had to pack into that first book. It's five books, and that's the first one. They're 250 pages each, so it's basically, you know, one story that's 1,250 pages.
Good Lord.
So there's a lot of it, and we're working with this medium, so we know, you know, that if a reader is hooked, they are likely to reread it. And so we want this to be dense and rereadable by design. But yeah, as you can see, I mean, we've had to wrestle with exactly that. Like you did a really nice job of actually keeping that reasonably clear. But yeah, it's all that, and it's more to come. So yeah, we were basically early on okay, this is going to be a team thing. We're gonna have to work at this with many hands. It's a 10-handed project.
We should also throw out a possible spoiler alert for those who have not read the book yet. You might want to stop this episode and go read the book. We urge you to do so. But can we talk a little bit about the Mimic?
Yeah. So the Mimic in the first book, we're circling around this villain, and it's a force. It's called the Mimic. It's neither living nor dead, and it's a kind of an imitation of life. It can copy certain things, but ultimately it's completely self-serving. Like, it knows nothing of kindness or real service or humanity. And it's a force, but then it manifests through the people it possesses, and it gets in through those qualities. It gets in through greed. And as we go, we're going to get to understand more, you know, where it came from and what it's doing. It's a tricky thing because, you know, there's always, when you're writing something like that, there's the danger of the amorphous villain, which we tried to sidestep, you know, by focusing on some of the people it possesses, at least at first. And then we're going to kind of come head on with it more directly.
Okay, I'm going to be annoying in two ways.
Okay,
and follow up on this. One, I'm going to be that guy who's like, oh, it kind of reminds me of this other thing, which it probably had nothing to do with. And then also, I'm going to show that I've read books. So as I was reading on page 145, Meadow says to Una of the Mimic, it could look like anyone, but there is one thing it cannot imitate, the living fire, for the Mimic is a creature of destruction only. And the first thing I thought of is, like, I wonder if this is in any way informed by Hindu philosophy of the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. And the only reason I bring this up is that I use this in my classrooms every once in a while. It's like tamas, or what's called dark inertia, it's an interesting deity, or rather, it's like sort of like a spiritual state of being where it has no creative force, no creative impetus of its own. So all it can do is destroy. So, like, as we chart different kinds of villains in my classes, I say, like, okay, this is like the villain who destroys for destruction's sake because it can't do anything else, right? It's not what we typically call a relatable villain. It's more of like an impersonal sort of cosmic villain.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I don't think that's come up as a reference between us. But now I'm going to have to go chasing after it. Here's the thing, is I feel like what's interesting with villains in general is the more real the underlying reflection, the more it's going to connect to all kinds of things. You know, and if you're writing a villain, then you have to contemplate evil and you have to ask yourself questions about evil. What is evil? How does it manifest? What does it do? I think the brilliance of, it's not even Smeagol, it's the ring itself in The Lord of the Rings, is that, you know, like, yes, you can draw parallels to anything evil from history, you know, but it escapes. It's not just, Tolkien never wanted to say it was really directly about the Nazis, but of course it applies. you know, and the effect it has on Gollum applies. If the reflection is real, then it's going to start resonating with things. That, I'm going to follow up that reference. That's really, really interesting. There are connections and references into all different cultures, into different things, but we also try and cover our tracks as best we can and kind of keep things referring within the story universe, essentially. You know, you don't want to immediately leap to like, oh, I mean, we do it right now. We're in the middle of the third book, and it's, you know, some of the stuff that you see from the mimic we're seeing right now on the world stage, and we didn't plan it that way, you know, but we're seeing the behavior of corruption, like brazen corruption, deceit, cruelty, you know, and we're seeing it. It's kind of in a stark contrast, you know, for all to see right now. So we're trying to like, okay, we don't want this to make it, you know, we don't want this to seem like, oh, this is just a book about our time, but it's a good sign if it resonates. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. And it leads to another question that I had, which I was picking up some undertones of like global warming and dealing with some things in our world that were coming from that book. And as things have changed with what's going on in our world, I was just curious if that is influencing it, or is that making you work harder to try to make it a more fantasy world and not reflect as much of what's going on in society today?
Yeah, no. I mean, I think it is, the thing about reflecting something is like, is it reflecting the specifics of your country or the political situation around you, or are you pushing the reflection to a deeper level, you know, which is where you get beyond the specifics and into like the essence of things, you know, what is actually the nature of this thing? You know, in America it manifests differently, in Russia it manifests differently, in Europe it manifests differently, in Pakistan, you know, in China, but if you can get to something that is, I mean, that's the weird thing about fantasy, is like my interest, my fundamental interest in fiction is truth. And I think, you know, the great fiction writers are very preoccupied with truth.
And I think that holds true for a lot of like fine art. I have an art history background, so it seems like a lot of definitions of art are coming across as being able to portray some sort of universal truth that is going to make anyone who is human connect with it. And I think that that's something that your story did really well.
Thank you. I mean, that's a crazy compliment. I mean, I feel that's one of the things that we're consciously reaching for, you know, and you it's very hard to know, you know, how well you do it. And I think time will tell, because sometimes things need some distance. But yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I feel like it's true. It's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be a cerebral truth. It can be a feeling truth. It can be, you know, like why the Impressionist movement captured something about perception. You know, they revealed, it's like it revealed something about a truth of it's like you can never look at light the same way after the revelation of Monet. You know, and then the Expressionists take it a step deeper, in a way, inward, right? And they're kind of, you're into pursuing a different truth, you know, that's like a little more like the personal perception.
I think of emotion and feeling, exactly.
Yeah.
I wonder if we could step aside just for a few minutes and talk a little bit about the publishing world again in relation to how things have changed in the way comics are accepted in schools and libraries now.
Yeah. I mean, I've just gone around a kind of a merry tour around the country, you know, in the big public libraries. Yeah, we talked about this in our email chain, but the demand from educators and librarians is huge right now. And, you know, one of my most popular workshops has been this one about using graphic novels in the classroom. We haven't, with first, second books, some of our books have literally thousands of course adoptions, you know, which is huge, because it's like every course adoption is 45 books, say.
That's incredible.
That are being offered every year, right? So yeah, we're definitely in a different moment. You know, I think it's funny because one of the talks I was giving was about the decade in comics and just looking back at like 10, 12 years, how things have changed. And I think the beginning, right around the time First Second got going, the manga thing was peaking, and it had just, in the space of just a few years, it had shifted comics from being 85% male readers to over 60% female readers. And out of that, creators, you know, so people were suddenly coming up through their ranks, not having read Wolverine, but having read, you know, Ranma 1-2 kind of thing. You know what I mean? Like a different school of comic. And then in the midst of all that, the European and the Asian and the American schools started really cross-pollinating. And so things changed creatively. And I think the gender balance was huge because it wasn't just female readers coming to it. It was just a more balanced and much more wide-ranging horizon opening up creatively, you know, for all creators, for all genders, you know, and that was very significant, you know. And so I think in terms of potential for comics to deepen, that's, to me, that was a big turning point, you know. So, and if they deepen, if they're exploring a greater range of the human experience, if they're making leaps and strides in fiction, in nonfiction, in memoir, then of course they're going to be studied because they're going to be worthy of study. You know, they're going to reward study. I think it would be rare to find a college that doesn't have some course that's not working with graphic novels.
Is there something that librarians and educators could do to make the acceptance of comics as actual books better, like beyond what's already been doing? Or is there something that you see missing within the world of libraries and bookstores?
Yeah, I mean, there are initiatives. I think the more informed, the more people can speak to the quality of something eloquently, you know, the better that is. I mean, in some ways, I feel like that battle has been won. It's just a lot of people are still catching up to that. But it's a bit like what you were saying. It's a bit this conversation we're having here, being able to dig in and appreciate the depth of a particular visual handwriting or a particular story or a particular author. I think it's going to happen through that. It's funny because the holdouts are not, it's not librarians, it's not teachers, it's parents, right? It's parents who still have this idea that it's a lesser literacy if it has pictures.
Yeah, I see that frequently at the library where in the summer when the kids come to get the books, they'll be like, okay, you can get that comic, but you have to get a real book too.
Exactly, exactly. And yes, I mean, it goes back to what I was saying earlier is like, yes, you can point to stuff that is shallow, but you can point to a lot of stuff that's very deep.
I mean, do you think some of that might come from the way we sometimes shelve things as well, though? Because we do have separate comic sections, so we are saying, hey, this is different. Do you think we should get to the point where they're all shelved, like a fiction with fiction, regardless of if it's a visual story or if it's
I'm not sure. I think there are good arguments on both sides. I tend to think that as a reading experience, it is different. It actually does work on different circuitries in the mind and in the brain. So I understand that it would be separated that way. You know, and that's partly why, in general, I'm not a big fan of hybrid prose and comics. You know, I feel like they rarely work. You know, when you're jumping, it's a kind of a jarring thing. And I read, like, on my own time, I'm reading mostly prose these days because I'm reading so much with comics when I'm at work, essentially. But I feel like they operate on very different parts of us, you know, so they're good at different things. And I think increasingly a well-rounded reading diet will include comics, you know, and I also think the reason I was saying I think the battle's been won already is that the teens, you know, the parents of tomorrow are the teen readers of today, you know, and they're totally growing up with, you know, they jump back and forth. They're highly visual. They're also highly verbal. So So they don't have a problem, you know, they don't have a problem with the format. It's not even an issue.
It is fascinating to me as somebody who has worked with adults in the past, how, because I grew up with them, the literacy and the fluency of my literacy is not apparent to me as much. And when I show some layouts, I was actually showing some Ernie Colon layouts to some adults, and they looked physically threatened by decoding what was happening on that page. And to me, it was like, no, it makes perfect sense. This is easy as pie. And it was a kindergarten teacher who said, "Why are you doing this to me?" Like, she was that threatened by and it occurred to me, like, oh yes, this is a very strange sort of reading to somebody who has never read that way before.
Yeah.
So I guess we should be buoyed by the fact that so many young people are reading them today, because you're right, they will be the parents of tomorrow, and they'll just be as natural as anything for them.
It really will be. It really will be. And I think the ones who make that leap, I think one of the most useful things we can tell them is slow down. You know, and yes, you're reading the words, but you actually need to read the pictures, and then you need to read how those two things dance with each other. And that, and for that, you have to slow down. You know, many times people who pick up a comic and they kind of flip through it impatiently and go, I can't. I've definitely seen that. I've seen that. It's like, it hurts my brain or something, you know, a bit like the first time people were picking up manga and reading from right to left is like, oh, why are they doing this to me? No, but it's kind of like if you read pictures, because a lot of what we've been talking about in this conversation is reading artwork, you know, reading lines, reading images, and reading text. And for that, it's many times it really involves just slowing down. And also, I think, connecting to a voice that resonates with you, you know, human to human, human passion to human passion. You know, when you find a person, I mean, it's a little bit like I mentioned my wife, Sienna, you know, so she grew up in ballet. We did a comic actually together about her life in ballet. And she was not especially warm to comics. I was not especially warm to ballet. You know? And ballet, you could call another kind of handwriting. You know, and if you go see a ballet, and it took me a while to actually shift, like to be able to sit through a ballet, took me a while, because I was like, I was going there like I was going to a movie, you know, and I was looking for plot and I was looking for characters, and it's very disappointing in that department. You know, almost every ballet is a disappointment if you're looking for plot. You know, except maybe I'd say Giselle is an exception, right? Giselle is actually a very special story as well, but even that you can't quite read with the same part of your faculties. So what are you reading with? Well, you're reading in time, you're reading movement, you're reading feelings through a kind of a very highly codified, in the case of ballet, you know, it's a very codified expression. So for me, it was like finding my way in was a little bit like some people for comics, you know, of like, okay, you got to connect to something that really stirs you, you know, really means something to you. And for me, you know, now I can see, okay, if you see Symphony in C and the Balanchine version of it, you have to be dead to not feel something. It's potent, you know, and it resonates, and it's like human stuff, you know, and so that to me is a way in. Like, that was a way in. Like, for some people, Persepolis was a way in, you know, the experience of an Iranian girl in comics form. Like, that was their way in. Some people it was Mouse, some people it was American Born Chinese, some people it was Anya's Ghost. You know, there's many, many, many entry points available. You know, like, you can take, like, someone who knows ballet really well and loves ballet can say, okay, look, you're not into ballet, let me just take you by the hand and help you. You know, and you get like ballet literacy.
So being able to connect with someone who is familiar with that language, who can then find your inroad or help you find your inroad. That makes a lot of sense.
I think so, right? I mean, I think it's a bit of that. You know, I think a bit of like, and reviewers can serve that purpose as well. you know, give an appreciation. Like when you have an appreciation, like I love when you see a good music critic, you know, they can give you a way in to appreciate something that maybe left you cold before. You know, suddenly you're like, oh yeah, I can see it through that lens. Or yeah, it's interesting stuff. I mean, coming back to your question, I think, yeah, the shelving, I think having more and more interesting conversations around comics that are not just about the format itself. You know, for a while, it was like every time there was a new article about the graphic novel explosion, it was always like the headline was always something like, bam, smack, pow, comics are not just for kids, you know, and it was like, oh, how clever. And, you know, and the thing about that is that it's a very limited conversation, you know. But if you're talking about the stuff of being human, you know, and someone's exploration of that, then it's limitless. You know, there's no end to that conversation. It only becomes more fascinating, whether you're into comics or not. For us to frame a conversation that gets to the real stuff, you know, the really important stuff, in which comics have something to offer, that's going to be a more interesting thing and more interesting articles in the papers.
If anybody listening to this found that interesting, listening to Mark talk about these topics, he's going to be appearing in Ann Arbor at the Ann Arbor Comic Arts Festival, a2caf.com, letter A, number 2, caf.com, which is what? It's a comics convention in Ann Arbor at the Ann Arbor District Library, right? Well, it's a festival. It's a comic arts festival, which means, what, 50-some artists come from around the country to table on the first floor at the library, and then every hour there is free hands-on participatory workshops, and Mark is going to be at the event to not only sign copies of Five Worlds and his other books, but he's going to be leading a How to Write Comics workshop during that weekend. That's June
16th and 17th.
June 16th and 17th, 2018. But there's something on the 15th, too.
On the 15th, we will have our pre-conference event, which is known as Incubate, Inkubate. And you can find out more about that online as well at the a2caf.com. web address. But that is a partnership with the University of Michigan. It's a pre-conference for anyone who wants to talk about comics, really. So educators, cartoonists, librarians, academics, anyone who's at all interested in talking with people who are enthusiastic and excited about comics. So the morning is going to be at Hatcher Library in the Hatcher Gallery on the campus of University of Michigan. And the afternoon will be hands-on workshops at the Ann Arbor District Library in the Secret Lab.
Very cool. And Mark's doing something for that, too. He's going to be doing a Comics in the Classroom. Did Jordy say that?
I don't think I did, but okay. He is. He's going to be one of the speakers that morning at the University of Michigan.
Very exciting. So that's at a2caf.com/incubate for more information on that. Thanks, Ann.
Thanks, Jersey.
So until next time, I have been Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey Drozd on Instagram.
And I still am Ann Drozd.
You're not going to do a credit for your Instagram?
I haven't been updating my Instagram.
Still, okay. And then that's the part where I say, okay, bye.